brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and Straight Talk with the Guys in the Community.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to Soft Rip Radio. Soft Rip Radio, on time, on target. You're on the air today with Steve Balestrieri. Joining us today, we have a very special guest. He's been in Soft Rip Radio before. He's been our guest, but it was a while ago. So we're trying to bring him back and catch up with what he's been up to. Eric Davis, who served our country as a U.S. Navy SEAL. He was a decorated veteran of the Global War on Terror. He was one of the premier sniper instructors, for the Navy, and their master training specialist at the sniper school in Coronado, California. We want to welcome him back. Eric, thanks for taking the time this afternoon to join us here on Soft Rip Radio. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, my absolute pleasure, Steve. Looking forward to doing the show with you.
Yeah, in fact, anyone who does stuff in the water gets my vote. I was a SF guy, but I was a mountain guy because I wasn't comfortable enough to do anything in the water. So scuba school for me was out of the question. So anyone who can do all the things that you guys did in the water, you get my vote, man.
Yeah, nice. Thank you. I appreciate it. It definitely does add another dynamic to anything you're doing with cold water splashing in your face. It definitely takes you through another ringer.
Yeah, because a buddy of mine that I used to work with after we both got out of the military, we did some security work for the Hollywood industry when they'd go overseas. And he had been through BUDS, and he told me the hardest thing to do is learn how to relax in the water, especially he said something about a beehive when you go through BUDS training where they put everyone kind of in a tight circle in the pool. And when he was describing it to me, I was like, yeah, I wouldn't have handled that very well.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. You could see some of the fellows were not ready for such a thing. It is definitely an experience when, you know, they fill your mask with water, push you tighter and tighter together. And then, of course, the only way to get to the top of the water is by moving some body part down. And typically that body part touches somebody else and they're trying to get to the top of the water. And your body part brings them underneath the water. So it's a good fun.
Yeah. He was telling me about that. And he was like, he's like, to me, that was the toughest part. He's like, I can handle the cold and all that. He goes, I mean, you get cold, you get miserable. And I'm sure you experienced all that same stuff. But he said, but that was for him personally, and everyone's different. But he said, that was the toughest part for me. And once I made it through that, I kind of had the feeling that no matter what else they throw at me, I think I can handle it.
Yeah, absolutely. That definitely is very trying for some people, for sure. It's not a natural feeling at all.
Now, how old were you, or how young were you when you went through SEAL training?
Oh, let's see. So I actually went twice. So first time I would have had to been like 22, 23, and then second time, about 25, give or take. I'd have to like do the math, but around 25.
And how many guys graduated in your SEAL class, or is that's not classified, right?
No, not classified at all. I do not remember exactly. Our class did graduate a large amount compared to most classes, though. Mm-hmm. So I do remember it being an anomaly, and I got to say it was like I want to say 77, but I don't, you know, want anyone researching me on the internet and then be like, you weren't in BUDS class 215, but I was, but it was like 70s, which is usually pretty high. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Cause I've heard, talking with some guys that I met through the service, most of the classes are down in like the 20s, 30s, maybe 40s from what I've heard. And they start with quite a few people. So there's a lot of guys who fall by the wayside due to one reason or another along the way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Lots of reasons not to make it.
Yeah. Now, when you began your SEAL career, were you on the West Coast or the East Coast?
I was West Coast the whole time.
Okay, so you were in California.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's funny because talking to that same buddy of mine that I worked with, he was like, the weirdest thing is watching people like at restaurants and bars while you're swimming in the surf and watching the surf wash over you. You can see people enjoying themselves. And I was like, see, that was the one difference. Like SF, when you go through like at Camp McCall in North Carolina, you're in the middle of basically nowhere. You know, it's pretty austere. It's in the middle of swampy like terrain that nobody really wants. I can't imagine you could actually see people kind of enjoying themselves while this is all going on.
Yeah, it is the weirdest thing. Like we used to describe, you know, SEAL training as like a little bit of a 9-to-5 thrashing in a way. And I don't mean that to like diminish the difficulty of it, but there used to be this cartoon, like when I was a kid, it was like the coyote and the sheepdog, and they would like clock in and just hammer each other, then clock out.
Yeah. And
so there was that kind of weird feel to it, because you're in beautiful Coronado, California, you know, you're doing beach runs, there's people hanging out on the beach, you know, you're out in the doing ocean swims, you're swimming across public beaches. So it is this strange thing during Hell Week, you're watching people in the restaurants as you're paddling around the island, and you know, you get done with the day and you go, you know, to this beautiful restaurant at, you know, Coronado. I mean, obviously not Hell Week. And then there's third phase and there's plenty of times we're out, but right. It is a strange environment, but I think it's very conducive. And maybe more better said, very appropriate to the kind of people that are attracted to becoming a SEAL. And just the kind of personalities, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and as in all of the special operations units, it all attracts. I mean, everyone's a little bit different, but I think it always attracts the same type of people, regardless of what unit it is, whether it's a Navy SEAL, or Air Force, you know, the Air Force Special Ops guys, the Army, Green Berets, and Rangers. They all have that same type of personality, the guys that are looking for something a little different than everyone else.
I agree. Yeah, I think fundamentally it's like the core human being, and then everybody has their different style. You know, I guess that's the only, it's just different style, same person, different style.
That's it. And then, you know, it ends up, we all end up working together anyway. So,
yeah.
So everyone has their own little quirks, but we're all on the same team at the end of the day.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, when you first became a SEAL, when your bio talks about global war on terror, were you in Afghanistan?
Say that again.
Did you do a tour in Afghanistan?
I did. So my platoon came home just before September 11th went down. So I was literally on post-deployment leave. I didn't have a TV. I just moved into a new place, didn't have a TV. Someone called me and like, hey, do you know what happened? And then what happens, they spun my platoon back up and said, you know, or not, like, hey, get ready to go back out because you guys are ready to go, you know, obviously already. And then they ended up sending Brandon's platoon, Brandon Webb, and didn't send our platoon. But it was also the time I could have gotten out of the Navy. But then what they did is they said, hey, if you reenlist, we'll send you to Afghanistan. So I'm like, that's easy. So I reenlisted and went to Afghanistan. I think shortly after, sometime in December, right after September 11th, a few months.
Oh, wow. So you were there in the very early stages of that.
Yeah, pretty early. Yep.
So our obviously Brandon Webb, who's, you know, the big honcho here at SOFREB, you guys have known each other for quite a few years. Were you instructors together?
Oh, we sure were. That's probably one of our most defining, you know, moments as SEALs for both of us. So we both went to Team 3. I deployed just ahead of him. Like I said, then his platoon came up behind us. I went to training cell a little bit ahead of him, and then I ended up in the sniper cell there. And then, I mean, just a few months, I mean, just by months, right? Then he joined sniper cell, and then we spent 5 years together training snipers, which is pretty unusual. Usually when you're an instructor, it's like a couple, 3 years. I think three years is about the max, but they're changing the course, and both him and I just really dug in on how to train snipers. So that him and I got very close and just spent a lot of time together, just in that field of expertise.
No, back in when you guys were teaching, what was the SEAL team sniper weapon? What were you guys using?
You know, it's so funny because I was never really that into guns, and I'm the worst guy when it comes to nomenclature with all this. But I'll describe some of the guns. But I remember at one point counting how many guns I had issued to me. I think it was like 22. And you know, SEALs are not short on budget and imagination. So, you know, we had the 7.62, the Remington, the 50 cal, and then the M4s. Then we had like accurized M4s with special barrels that, you know, kind of were considered part of our sniper suite. I started with an M14 with custom stock, like when I went through sniper school, like the legit, that was the semi-automatic 7.62 before the, SR-25 came out. Mm-hmm. So I gotta say we had to have them all, for as far as I can tell. Like they were.
So you guys trained them on everything.
Yeah. Yeah. So in sniper cell, like the basic course, it was basically by caliber. You know, you had your 300 Win Mag, your 308, and that was our primary focus. But then, you know, Brandon and I were both in advanced sniper cell as well. So then you're using all the different guns.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, because everyone loves to, you know, I mean, I don't care if you're a sniper or not, everyone loves doing long range shooting because it's like, I don't know, it's just one of those military things. And I know whenever we'd go on a deployment, if we were somewhere where it availed itself, we'd have to stop what we were doing, never failed, and see who could shoot the best. So I'm sure it was the same with you guys when it comes to long range shooting. And of course, yeah, we got to play with some different stuff as well when it comes to 7.62. They use it was the 300 Winchester mag, and of course the 50 cal came along later on. I'm probably a little bit older than you are, so yeah. But yeah, all that stuff was always fun, and it's always interesting because I know what you know. Sniper school is extremely difficult. People don't understand. They think it's all only about shooting. If you're a civilian, they think it's just about shooting, but there's so much more to it. You have to know your math too when you go there.
Oh, you sure do. It's you know, I remember, I think they'd send like two or three guys per platoon in hopes of getting one sniper. So, I mean, this is a course that full SEALs went to and failed on a regular basis. And it is way more. So, I mean, there's the whole reconnaissance and surveillance aspect of becoming a sniper. I mean, the first 4 weeks, well, actually in our course, we're teaching digital photography mm-hmm. because surveillance is a big part of sniping. And then I think that was 2 weeks when I was there. And then 4 weeks, this was the course I was in charge of, which was called the Scout course. But that's mm-hmm. where we're teaching all the ghillie suit stuff, the hides, the stalking, and then 6 weeks of shooting. So it's not even, you know, it's about half. And then during the shooting, you're still doing the field craft too, with the digital photography, memorization techniques, observation techniques, I mean, everything. It is a... You got to be into it, I guess. You got to be into it. It's very specialized.
And you did that for 5 years?
5 years I taught that. Man, I remember like every once in a while I'd have the opportunity to kind of train with LAPD SWAT or just kind of help them out or be on the same range with them. And I can remember sitting behind those guys and because, you know, you watch one of the things you learn as a sniper is to watch what they call bullet trace. So you actually watch the bullet go down range and there's a way kind of looks like the Matrix, as you know, and there's a way you can tell whether the person mm-hmm. hit or missed, you know, well before they know. And yeah, after 5 years, you know, full time too, I can remember like being with these SWAT teams are like, what? And they like started calling me Yoda. They're like, how did you know? How can you know? And I'm like, dude, it's not, I'm telling you, man, 5 straight years I've been doing this. Like I know where you shot that bullet, whether you do or not.
Now, did you work with some of the our allies who have sniper units?
You know, I never worked with them in that capacity. I mean, I've been on deployment and did the FID stuff, foreign internal defense, where we're, you know, we're training them in different things, but I was not a sniper when my platoon was doing that. Then, yeah, my second deployment, I don't think we did any of that kind of work because we were pirating so many damn ships. We were just taking ships down left and right because it was just right before the war. And I don't know necessarily the relation, but we are definitely ramped up taking down ships coming out of Iraq for UN and any kind of embargo infringement. So we are busy.
Yeah. Now, you wrote a couple of books, Raising Men from Fathers to Sons, Life Lessons in SEAL Training. You also have another one that's out, Habits of Heroes. What was the motivations of writing the books?
You know, I'll tell you, so the whole time I was in the SEAL teams, it's funny. So sometimes I'll hear about like other SEALs being mad at someone for writing a book. And I'm like, wait, we are all there because we read a book or watched all the movies. Like, there ain't.
That's right.
I'm like, come on, dude. What are you even talking about? But, and everyone's always talking about stuff like that. But I just thought, because I was a very young parent, right? I had my first kid at like 19 years old. And I was just right out of the box, young parent. So I was a parent. You know, I went through Marine reconnaissance training, SEAL training. I was a very young parent this whole time. And I just thought, like, it's just an interesting perspective. Like, how's my life look as a parent? And then, you know, I lived in South Orange County. And you want to talk about a contrast. So, you know, one day I could be deployed in Africa, fly home, and then I'm at a barbecue in the most suburbia, you know, place there could, you know what I mean? It's just like the most suburban kind of place you could be. And I just had a little different thinking around parenting. And of course, I'm training with Olympic gold medalists to learn how to train snipers better. So I, you know, I'm learning behavior science. I'm just learning all these different things. So I just thought, man, what an interesting perspective. And this was before SEAL books were popular too. I mean, people had written books before me, but I was thinking about this a long time ago. And I'm like, geez, someone has to be interested in a SEAL's perspective on raising a kid or a SEAL's perspective on finance. I don't know. It's just like, we got a different way of looking at things. So that just drove me to do it. And then
right. Because it isn't one of the typical book, you know, when people think, oh, a book about Navy SEALs written by a Navy SEAL, they're expecting a different type of book. You know, what we used to call in the Army, the HUA books, you know, this is, you know, you're expecting a bunch of war stories. This was geared, obviously, differently.
Yeah, absolutely. So I started off with that as a personal development writer, and I still am a personal development writer. So where the SEAL stories come in is they're just great kind of extreme examples of how we get things done in dynamic environments. And what's good about that I learned that as a sniper instructor, I'm like, well, if you really just inflate the example, you're going to be able to see the nuances, the small things. You know, if you inflate the example of shooting a bullet down range and make the bullet really big and make the wind 100 times bigger, you can see what's affecting things, cause and effect. So that was just always my passion. And I got really good at training snipers. Like when Brandon and I were there, we brought the failure rate way down. I mean, we were part of a team, but I always, you know, blame myself for the good stuff because the team's not here right now. Right. But it's like, we like, you know what I mean? So everything for me is all personal development. I use the stories to explain a point, and it's a trusted source, right? So SEALs are known to perform. So it's like, hey, there's all kinds of like charlatans out there trying to peddle personal development. Like, it's crazy. And I got caught up when I was young and it just didn't work for me. And it just makes sense. Like, we're performers, people know we're performers. And when we can bridge the gap from what we did to now what we do as individuals, as parents, as corporate executives, whatever, it really makes a quick difference.
Yeah. You know, from your own perspective, having a child when you're young like that at 19, it must've been difficult when your kids are growing up and you're on deployment. Because speaking for myself, I have one son, but I didn't have him until I was out. You know, I had got out of the military after 17 years. So, you know, I can't imagine. I knew guys, obviously we were around, both of us were around people that, you know, having families at home, that's one of the toughest things to do is being deployed when you're away from your family. How difficult was that? I mean, especially at a young age like that.
So it is difficult to be away from them, but I would say for me, now I've been an entrepreneur. I've been an entrepreneur and then I became a full-time writer. So entrepreneur since 2008, which is a really tough economy, obviously, to start being a business owner. And then a few years after that, I became a full-time writer. So I bring that up because of this. So it is difficult to be away from your kids. But I have found that I have been more present. I was more present with my kids that I had when I was in the teams and deploying, because when I was home, I was home. When I was on the phone with them, I was on the phone with them. Here's the thing. You can fail at a SEAL mission. I mean, there's really bad failures where people die, of course, but there's lots of failures where you're like, oh, I failed. And you still get paid. You still keep all your medical. You know what I mean? Everything's okay. So it's an interesting kind of question. But for me, it was infinitely more difficult to be a parent outside of the teams. And I love sharing this with people, because when I'm teaching someone, whether it's one of my members in my courses or I'm just talking to parents in general, I talk about just the life or death nature of what we're doing as a parent or what we're doing as an executive, you know, like whatever we're doing. They're like, well, it's nothing to compare to what you're doing in the SEAL teams. I'm like, oh, no. It absolutely is different. Because in the SEAL teams, again, assuming nothing really bad happens, you do 20 years and you can retire and you get that money for the rest of your life. But in the regular world, there's lots of reasons you're not going to retire. There's lots of reasons you're not going to get paid the next month, you know, so... and it's hard to be present with your kids when you're worried about stuff like that.
That's a great point. I mean, the civilian world, and, you know, we've all gone through that. It is very different. And it's an eye-opening experience when you spend most of your adult life in the military. And then when you do leave, you know, life definitely changes. And I know a lot of guys, myself included, after... I thought I was prepared for civilian life when I get out, and I don't really feel like I was. So that's a great point.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I've done a couple of news hits when, you know, there were a lot of the suicides happening. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they ask your opinion, and this is opinion. I'm not a doctor. I don't study all this stuff, but one of the things I shared with them, was, I was like, I don't know the cause of all the pain, you know, I mean, people after they're out of the military, but I do know this. I do know from the time they're 18, 19 years old, they were able to afford their own place, able to buy a car. You get yourself a credit card at Nordstrom's or Macy's, wherever it is you like, you know what I mean? Like you can do all that. And then you get out of the military, and what happens is you left the job that was allowing you to live like kind of an adult life. And you watch a lot of our veterans suffer, and it's really like, there's no really kind way to say it. It's because they left. And the military doesn't prepare you for that, and they don't even tell you, you know what I mean? It's not like they warn you, like, hey, it's not going to quite be like you think. So, you know, I feel for those guys, all, you know, the guys and gals all the time that are struggling. I always wish there was a better transition program. And it's not just transition, like how to go get a job. It's like, hey, you got to understand that you had the full boat. You know what I mean? You had a full career level job, and now you're going to go out into a different world where it's not necessarily going to be that case.
Right. And, you know, I did read, and I talked to a friend of mine. We served together in SF, but he's been working in conjunction with some SEALs, and they're putting together, I believe it's the Navy SEAL Foundation. I could be wrong about that, but they're putting together a really good transition program for the guys that are getting out now, because it is different. It's an eye-opening experience. And I think a lot of the guys really miss that close interaction with each other, that, you know, you can trust that guy that's next to you right now with your life, and he'll trust you with his. But not that feeling when you get out. And I think a lot of guys struggle with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And corporate America and just the marketplace, it's just different, you know. It's not that people are bad, but it's, yeah, in the military, and especially special forces, it's like, hey, I'm going to ride this one down with you, you know, even if it causes me to fail too. And, right. And that environment is more conducive to do that because it's set up for that. It's a culture, but it's a little bit more, I got to get mine in corporate America. And I'm not saying that's bad. I'm just saying it's just a little bit more different. That way. It's different. Yeah. And it doesn't have to be that way. But it's just different. And you expect people to have your back, and they don't.
Right. So, you know, what was the reaction to the guys you served with, the guys you were friends with, when you did write the books? Because I know a lot of, and SF guys are the same way. Anyone who writes a book, everyone's first reaction is the negative one. But, you know, you were close to a lot of people, obviously, Brandon being one of them, but after they read your books, what was the reaction with that after the fact?
So, you know, it hasn't been bad for me because I think, again, my stuff's personal development. So, you know, there are SEAL stories, but I think where people get most of the heat is when they're sharing war stories, you know what I mean? And stuff like that. Yeah. And, you know, someone's like, oh, it didn't happen that way. Or like, why are you sharing that? And again, I'm like, dude. Like, come on, like people like, and hey, here's another thing. So I've been spared from that quite a bit. I think just because the nature of being in personal, I mean, like everything I'm doing is to help a human being identify their purpose in life and live it out. It's like, how mad at me can you get? Like, like, come on, dude. But you know, here's another thing, just while we're on that topic, those stories aren't ours to keep. Like, we go out and have those experiences. Those are the stories for Americans. Actually, they're the stories for the world. It would be a shame not to share those stories, write books, make movies, whatever. You know what I mean? Like, that's our history. That's what happened to us. Or that's our recollection of what happened. But those aren't, you know what I mean? I'm like, hey, it's not even, it's selfish to keep those stories to yourself. Like, share them with everybody.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. You almost said word for word what my father fought in World War II, and I never knew. Even after I was in the military, I was in SF, I come home. He never talked about what he saw. Now, I know he fought all the way across France into Germany, liberated a concentration camp. I knew all that, but he would never talk about it. It wasn't until he died that, you know, one of the guys that was in his tank, he was in armor unit during the Second World War. And one of the guys from his tank crew came to the wake and talked to my brother and I and handed me a book that my father was like featured in. And he said basically the same thing. I said, you know, my father never talked about this stuff. Now I'm going to read a book that he's in. And he said those stories belong to everyone because, you know, when guys like your dad pass away, they're gone forever. And people need to know about them, good or bad. We need to know about everyone's experiences. And I think that's a good, I know we're getting off the topic here, but I just, when you said that, it kind of rang a bell in my mind. So I wanted to mention that, but let's move on. You have a webinar that's going on and, you know, again, personal development. And can you talk to our listeners about that?
So, you know, a few months ago, I mean, it kind of happened. It coincided with the whole COVID thing, but I was already marching down this path. But again, you know, 5 years as a SEAL sniper instructor, I learned a thing or two about performance. Mm-hmm. And how I describe it, you know, it's like I basically just stumbled across a formula. And, you know, I had got, like I said, I got out of the military. It was, you know, 4 or 5 years later. I was like, here, I'll give you the whole story, actually. So buddy's like, hey, what still fires you up? And I was just like, oh, crap. I knew I was done because, like, nothing. You know, I'd got sucked into that kind of corporate, kind of meaningless world. I was just working. I was a paycheck producing machine. You know what I mean? Like I said, I just was just, like, not living life that way. And what I did was I was just thinking, like, man, I've used kind of that formula and the principles I was using as a sniper instructor to train financial advisors, train other people. I'm like, why not? Like, can I just point that all at, like, living a really good life? Can I point that at like life itself? And then sure enough, I did. And I figured it out. I'm like, oh my gosh, fundamentally speaking, training snipers or a sales team or training snipers or yourself or a kid, if you are performing at a high level, fundamentally speaking, at the core, you have to be doing certain things. You know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. there are things that have to be happening. And the beauty of having gotten to taught snipers for 5 years at that such a high level, I basically whittled it down to like 4 or 5 things. Like, okay, well, here are the, you know, 4 or 5 core things that you can apply anywhere. So what I did is I launched a webinar. There's 3 strategies in particular that if you sequence them together, you can pretty much get it all done. And, you know, there's stuff I do in my membership course when people end up training with me and stuff like that, where I take it further. And I just thought, like, I got to do this. I got to launch this webinar so that people, again, they're not my performance secrets to hold on to. You know what I mean? Like, right. I don't get to keep them. So it's like I wanted to share it with people. So I put it right on the front page of my website and just made it accessible to everyone. And then when I'm done, I'll invite people in to join us if they want to take it further and train with us. But yeah, basically deployed the 3 core strategies that I found not only impacted my ability to train snipers, but allowed me to find my purpose in my life and live it out in a very powerful manner. So I just, like, I got to share it.
Yeah, because your webinar is free. And, you know, anyone who wants to check it out, I encourage all our listeners and our readers for softrep.com to go and check it out. It's at, I hope I don't screw up your website, ericdavis215.com. And I didn't screw that up. I don't have it in front of me, but I thought I remembered it. That's why I was worried that I'd forget about that. But before we move on, I had to ask you a question. I did check out your website last night. There was a picture of you sitting on a motorcycle, obviously in some kind of Arabic country. Where was that taken?
That was actually in northern Sudan. And I was actually a civilian then. So,
oh, you were?
Yeah, strange world. Just, you know, like, I'll tell you what, I grew up in, again, the suburb of San Francisco, a place called Foster City, and just surfing and doing my thing. And then, you know, something about, you know, joining the SEALs and you just live that life. And it's just, I've never, traveling around the world never was occurred to me, you know, growing up. And now it's like, I can't stop it. Like, what, I keep ending up, why am I in northern Sudan? Like, and there I am on a gun range, you know.
Yes, I saw that picture and I was like, I wonder where that's at, because he's tooling around on a motorcycle. It has to be semi-permissive, I would think, but you never know. So, and now the Sudanese are making peace with the Israelis, which is, who would have ever thought that, right?
Oh, yeah. So many things are changing in the world right now. People are going to have to coordinate and cooperate a lot better if they're going to survive. And the ones that can't coordinate and cooperate, I just don't think are going to make it. You know what I mean? I don't think it's going to work out for them.
Yeah. Back to the webinar though. And again, you talk about, if people want to take it a bit farther, you have a membership course. Where do you teach that in California?
So it's taught online right now. So basically what happens on that webinar, at the end of the webinar, I use it as another class. I'm like, okay, and now I'm going to, if you guys want to take this forward on your own, here's how I teach it to my members. Mm-hmm. So I give them like a mini class, but it's also describing the program, you know what I mean, on how it goes. But basically what happens is there's an online course that's self-paced where they can start learning all these, the structures and strategies and principles that I discovered when I was a sniper instructor, and they can learn how to apply it to life or any situation. And then I meet with my tribe. It's called Tribe 215. I meet with them live twice a month. And then members of Tribe 215, I also conduct, not during at the moment, but I also conduct excursions throughout the year, sea, air, and land. So they're like little mini SEAL style excursions. And it's members of that tribe. They're the only ones invited. So it's not like a public thing. Mm-hmm. So you get a mix of people. There's people like, yeah, I want to get into it, start living a better life, get more aware, get this stuff done. Some people like, yeah, I want to become part of a tribe, so I'm not trying to do life by myself. So I'm getting some adventure, some fun, some fitness, you know what I mean? Finally going again. And, you know, a lot of guys, I mean, there's men and women, but we got a lot of men and they're just like, man, I lost my bubble. You know what I mean? I used to work out. I used to be in shape. I used to have passion. I used to, you know, be be after what I was after. And they're like, a lot of them share that same thing I said. They became a paycheck producing machine. And they're confusing sitting around drinking with having a tribe. And it's like, no, there's ways to be parts of people where you're actually impacting the world and your own personal life and doing it in a very powerful way and drinking.
Right. And how small are these, like, what you call the tribe? How small are these tribes that are in your membership course?
So it's actually what I did is I started off with one big group. Mm-hmm. And then there's a couple options when people registered, like they could become what I'd call a lifetime member. And then mm-hmm. I separate that group into a smaller group. So I continuously will segment groups by size. But then we also have a Slack channel where the entire tribe goes, and then we help them facilitate starting study groups and start building a tribe on their own. So it's, I think, particularly unique about what I do is, as a trainer, I always found it, most trainers just kind of show off what they do and then people hope to get to be like that. And as a trainer, I found it important to actually transfer skill and capacity. So I want to make people autonomous. So a whole bunch of what I do is I help these people. I actually teach how to build a tribe. I help them identify people to bring into their world. And then I help them understand the practices to be in to continuously cultivate that tribe so that they can impact one another. So I basically, how I would describe it is, I'm always trying to work myself out of a job. So I want these pods of people out there, because if you look at the world, the middle will go away, right? The world was already competitive and dynamic before the virus. And now after, it was going that way anyways. And now it's getting really competitive and dynamic. People are not going to be able to survive by themselves. And they're certainly not going to be able to thrive or lead anybody else through any of this by themselves. So I want to create these pods of people, these small tribes. So, and basically, I need them to live a very good life, so that they can inspire and teach others. And not like on some multi-level way. I mean, like they're human beings out there doing this on their own now and inviting people into their world and spreading it. That to me is peace. When people's life, you know what I mean? When you look at our enemies, it's like, they don't want bad things. They want a house. They want security. They want food. They want hospitals. It's how they're going about getting those things. That's the problem. So if you increase people's power, which is their time, money, energy, creativity, that will allow them to get the good things that we all want, but do it in a way where they don't have to hurt somebody else. So to me, this is my path to peace. This is how you stop a war 10, 15, 20 years before it happens.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no, that was it. I was like, oh, I was fired up there for a second. Then I stopped.
Yeah.
Like,
okay, no, that's great. I mean, I think that it's fascinating stuff. And now, are you getting a wide segment of different people, like different people with different professions coming into this?
I do. It really started off with like high level executives and entrepreneurs, because I was doing really small personal groups and like real high price points, because you kind of have to get started in this world. Mm-hmm. But I didn't like the idea that it wasn't accessible to everybody. And I remember I went on KTLA News in LA, and it was talking about toxic masculinity and like why, you know, I think some kid had shot something up, you know what I mean? It was one of those deals. And that's where this all came together. I'm like, this performance principles that I teach, it's like I said, it applies to everyone in every situation. So I would say, for the most part, what I attract right now are men that are between the ages of 35 and upwards of to about 60. But we have mm-hmm. more women coming in, more younger people coming in. And that's what I'm after, because again, it's when life doesn't work out is when people start getting selfish. It's when life doesn't start like go the way they want it to go, they start losing hope. And when you lose hope, you start getting angry and depressed. And that's when violent, you know, all kinds of bullshit starts happening.
Exactly. Yeah. And it starts to snowball in the wrong direction at that point.
It sure does. And you could see the opposite. So one of the things that also drove me, it's like, do you know what happens when a good person's life starts to work out? You know what I mean? You know, people are like, man, I'm 100% pinned just to make the paycheck and get home. Great. So if I work with them, I'm like, okay, well, what if that only takes 90% of your capacity and now you have 10% to deploy somewhere else? Do you know what good people always do the moment they have extra capacity? They look outwards. They start looking around for other people they can help. It's really quite amazing. It's when you're like, why aren't people helping people? And everyone's like, oh, people should be more generous and everything like that. It's like, people should be more powerful. You give good people power. And typically what I have found is that they take that power and redeploy it to people with that are less fortunate. But they got to have it. They got to have the capacity. If they're burning the candle at both ends just to make ends meet, they're not helping anybody.
See, now you've already sold me. I'm sitting here listening to you. I want to sign up for your program, man.
Good. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if you take old guys into your program, but I'm ready, man. I'm ready. No, I think this is fantastic. And I didn't mean that sarcastically in any way whatsoever. I mean, I think you're definitely onto something there. And I think it's fascinating. Like I said, I wish there was programs like this around when I get out, because I think I would have been ready for something like this. But hey, I just wanted to thank you for taking the time today. I know it was short notice, and you know, we kind of asked you on the fly if you'd come on, and we really appreciate it. And again, before we go, I just have to read something real quick. If for those of you who would like to get SoftRep on your phone, you can download the SoftRep app and get all our articles and podcasts, all the great content on there. And we appreciate everyone listening. And please, you know, keep in touch with us. Let us know how we're doing. We always like feedback, good or bad, because that's the only way we learn. So for everyone here at SoftRep.com and SoftRep Radio, we want to thank Eric. Thanks for taking the time today. This is really awesome stuff. And it was really a pleasure talking to you this afternoon.
Awesome. You are most welcome. It's my absolute pleasure. And thank you for allowing me to share the things I've learned and get that message out there to other people that there's a better way and another way. And so I'm always appreciative when I have an opportunity to share it through your guys' channel. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. And like I said, I'll be checking that out myself. I think just listening to you, you got me sold, man. So, you know, there's always a better way to skin a cat. And I think you're onto something, you know, with people with personal development. I don't think there's enough of it going on in the world today. And, you know, I was intrigued when I was reading this last night, and I look forward to checking it out some more. So thanks again once for joining us today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you for having me. Take care.
All right. Take care.
You've been listening to SoftRep Radio.